Liza turned her attention back to the range. Would you like tea? No, he said, feeling somewhat bested, though he wasn't sure how. I must get back. Rose doesn't know you're here. I must get back. He returned his hat to his head and started for the kitchen door. Did you see it? It turned out well, I think. Nathaniel paused, but did not turn. Goodbye, Eliza. I will not see you again. He thrust his arms into his coat and pushed aside the niggling, unnameable doubts. He was almost at the door when he heard Eliza in the hall behind him. Wait, she said, some of her composure shed. Allow me a closer look at the girl, at Rose's daughter. Nathaniel pressed his fingers against the cool of the metal doorknob, clenched his back teeth together as he pondered her request. It will be my last. How could he refuse such a simple appeal? A look. Then I must take her back, take her home. Together they went through the front door into the garden. Ivory was sitting by the edge of the small pond, bare toes curled over the bank so that they kissed the water, singing to herself as she pushed a leaf along the surface. As the child looked up, Nathaniel placed his hand gently on Eliza's arm and pushed her forward. The wind had picked up, and Linus had to lean against his cane to avoid losing his footing. Down in the cove, the usually mild sea had been agitated so that small waves with white tips rushed towards the shore. The sun was hiding behind a blanket of clouds, a far cry from the perfect summer's days he had once spent in the cove with his poupee. The little wooden boat had been Georgiana's, a gift from father, but she had been glad to share it with him. Hadn't thought for a moment that his weak leg made him any less of a man, never mind what father said. On afternoons when the air was warm and sweet, they had paddled out together to the center of the cove. Sat, while waves lapped gently against the base of the boat, neither of them caring for anything but the other. Or so Linus had thought. When she'd left, she'd taken with her the frail sense of solidarity that he had nursed. The sense that though father and mother judged him a foolish boy with neither worth nor function, he had something to offer. Without Georgiana, he was useless again. Purposeless. Thus had he determined she must be returned. Linus had hired a man. Henry Mansell, a dark and shadowy character whose name was whispered in the inns of Cornwall and passed on to Linus by the valet of a local earl. It was said he knew how to take care of matters. Linus told Mansell of Georgiana and the harm done to him by the fellow who stole her. Told him also that the man worked on the ships in and out of London. The next Linus knew, the sailor was dead. An accident, Mansell said, face registering no emotion. A most unfortunate accident. It was a strange sensation that animated Linus that afternoon. A man's life had been extinguished at his will. He was powerful, able to inflict his inclination on others. It made him want to sing. He'd given Mansell a generous payment, then the man had taken his leave, headed off in search of Georgiana. Linus had been filled with hope, for surely there were no limits to what Mansell could achieve. His poupee would be home presently, grateful for her rescue. Things would be as they had been before. The Black Rock looked angry today. Linus felt his heart lurch as he remembered Georgiana sitting on its top. He reached into his pocket and pulled out the photograph, smoothed it gently with his thumb. Poopy. Half thought, half whisper. No matter how Mansell had hunted, he'd never found her. He'd scoured the continent, followed leads across London, all to no avail. Linus had heard nothing until late in 1900, when word had come that a child had been found in London. A child with red hair and her mother's eyes. Linus's gaze lifted from the sea, swept sideways to the top of the cliff that bound the left-hand side of the cove. From where he stood, he could just make out the corner of the new stone wall. How he had rejoiced at news of the child. He'd been too late to recover Georgiana, but through this girl would she be returned. But things had not played out as he'd expected. Eliza had resisted him, had never understood that he had sent for her, brought her here, so that she might know she belonged to him. And now her presence tormented him, locked away in that accursed cottage. So close, and yet 4 years it had been. 4 years since she had set foot on this side of the maze. Why was she so cruel? Why did she deny him over and again? A sudden gust of wind, and Linus felt his hat lift at the sides. He reached from instinct to stop it, and as he did, his grip loosened on his photograph. On the current of the hilltop breeze, while Linus stood helplessly, his poupee was blown from his reach. Down and up, fluttering on the wind, shining white beneath the glare of the clouds, hovering, teasing him, before being swept further away, landing finally on the water and being carried out to sea. Away from Linus, slipping through his fingers once more. Ever since Eliza's visit, Rose had been worrying, tying her mind in knots as she sought a path through this dilemma. When Eliza had made her appearance through the maze gates, Rose had suffered the peculiar shock of a person who comes suddenly to understand that they are in danger. Worse, that they have been in danger for some time without realizing it. She had felt a sudden onset of lightheadedness and panic. Relief that so far nothing had happened, and dread certainty that such luck could not hold. For all Rose had weighed up the options, there was only one thing she knew for sure. Mama was right. They needed to put a distance between themselves and Eliza. Rose pulled the thread gently through her needlepoint and schooled her voice into a tone of perfect nonchalance. I have been thinking again of the visit from the authoress. Nathaniel looked up from the letter he was penning, chased quickly the concern from his gaze. As I said before, my dear, think no more upon it. It won't happen again. You can't be sure of that, for who among us predicted this most recent visit? Sterner now. She will not come again. How do you know? Nathaniel's cheeks flushed. The change was only slight, but Rose noticed. Nate? What is it? I have spoken with her. Rose's heart tapped faster. You saw her? I had to, for you, dearest. You were so upset by her visit, I did what was needed to ensure it won't happen again. But I didn't mean for you to see her. This was worse than Rose had imagined. A surge of heat beneath her skin, and she was filled with an even stronger certainty that they must get away. All of them. That Eliza must be extricated forever from their lives. Rose slowed her breath, schooled her face to relax. It wouldn't do to have Nathaniel think she was unwell, and was making decisions without reason. Speaking with her is not enough, Nate. Not any more. What else can be done? Surely you don't suggest we lock her in the cottage. He'd been trying to make her laugh, but she didn't flinch. I've been thinking about New York. Nathaniel's brows raised. We have spoken before of spending time across the Atlantic. I think we should bring forward our plans.
Leave England?
Rose nodded. Slightly, but certainly. But I have commissions. We spoke of engaging a governess for Ivory.
Yes, yes, Rose said impatiently, but it is no longer safe.
Nathaniel said nothing in return, but he didn't need to. His expression spoke volumes. The little ice chip inside Rose hardened. He would come around to her way of thinking. He always did, especially when he feared that she teetered atop the slide to despair. It was regrettable, using Nathaniel's devotion against him, but Rose had little other choice. Motherhood and family life were all Rose had dreamed of. She didn't intend to lose them now. When Ivory was born, placed in Rose's arms, it was as if they had all been granted a fresh start. She and Nathaniel were happy again. They never spoke of the time before. It didn't exist any longer. Not so long as Eliza stayed away.
I have the engagement in Carlisle, said Nathaniel. I've already started.
In his voice, Rose perceived the cracks that she would widen until his resistance crumbled.
And, of course, you must be able to complete it, she said. We will bring forward the Carlisle engagement, sail directly after we return. I have 3 tickets for the Carmania.
You've booked already. A statement rather than a question. Rose softened her voice. It is best, Nate. You must see that. It's the only way we will ever be safe. And think what such a trip will do for your career. Why, the New York Times may even report it. A triumphant homecoming for one of the city's most accomplished sons. Pressed beneath Grandmama's favorite sprung chair, Ivory whispered the words to herself. New York. Ivory knew where York was. Once, when they were traveling north to Scotland, she and Mama and Papa had stopped for a time in York at the house of one of Grandmama's friends. A very old lady with wiry spectacles and eyes that looked always to be weeping. But Mama wasn't speaking of York. Ivory had heard her clearly. New York, she'd said. They must go soon to New York. And Ivory knew where that city was. It was far across the sea, the place in which Papa had been born, about which he had told her stories full of skyscrapers and music and motor cars, a city where everything gleamed. A clump of dog hairs tickled Ivory's nose, and she fought to hold in a sneeze. It was one of her most impressive skills, the ability to halt sneezes in their track, and part of what made her such an excellent hider. Ivory so enjoyed hiding that sometimes she did so for no other reason than to please herself. Alone in a room, she would conceal herself for the pure pleasure of knowing that even the room itself had forgotten she was there. Today, though, Ivory had hidden with purpose. Grandpapa had been in odd spirits. Usually he could be counted upon to keep himself to himself, but lately he'd appeared wherever Ivory was, calling her his own. Always with his little brown camera, trying to take photos of her with that broken dolly of his. Ivory didn't like the broken dolly with her horrid blinking eyes. So, although Mama said she should do as Grandpapa asked, that it was a great honor to have one's photograph taken, Ivory preferred to hide. Thoughts of the dolly made her skin prickle, so she tried to think of something else. Something that made her happy, like the adventure she'd been on with Papa through the maze. Ivory had been outside playing when she'd seen Papa emerge from the side door of the house. He'd walked quickly, and at first she had thought he might be taking a carriage to paint somebody's portrait. Only he didn't have any of his equipment with him, nor was he dressed in quite the same way he usually was when he had an important meeting. Ivory had watched him stride across the lawn, drawing closer to the maze gate, and then she'd known exactly what he was doing. He wasn't good at pretending. Ivory hadn't thought twice. She'd hurried after Papa, followed him through the maze gates and into the dark, narrow tunnels. For Ivory knew that the lady with the red hair, the one who had brought the parcel for her, lived on the other side. And now, after her visit with Papa, she knew who the lady was. Her name was the authoress, and though Papa said she was a person, Ivory knew better. She'd suspected it the day the authoress had come through the maze, but after looking into her eyes in the cottage garden, Ivory had known for certain. The authoress was magical. Witch or fairy, she wasn't sure, but Ivory knew the authoress wasn't a person like any other she'd seen before. Chapter 43, Cliff Cottage, 2005. Outside, the wind worried the treetops, and the ocean breathed heavily in the cove. Moonlight streamed through the window pane, casting four silvery squares across the wooden floor, and the warm tomato smell of soup and toast had impregnated the walls, the floor, the very air. Cassandra, Christian, and Ruby sat around the table in the kitchen, the range glowing on one side, a kerosene heater on the other. Candles were lined along the table and at various points about the room, but there were still spaces in the dark, lonely corners where candlelight failed to reach.
"I still don't understand," said Ruby. "How do you know Rose was infertile from that journal article?"
Christian spooned a mouthful of soup.
"The X-ray exposure. There's no way her eggs would have survived."
"Wouldn't she have known, though? I mean, surely there'd have been a sign that something was wrong."
"Like what?"
"Well, did she still, you know, get her periods?"
Christian shrugged his shoulders.
"I guess so. The function of her reproductive system would have been unaffected. She still would have released an egg each month. It's just the eggs themselves that would have been damaged."
"So damaged she couldn't conceive?"
"Or if she did, there'd have been so much wrong with the baby that she would most likely have miscarried, or given birth to a child with massive deformities."
Cassandra pushed the last of her soup aside. "That's terrible. Why did he do it?"
"He probably just wanted to be amongst the first to make use of the shiny new technology. Enjoy the glory of publication." "There was certainly no medical reason to take an X-ray. The kid had only swallowed a thimble."
"Who hasn't?" said Ruby, wiping a crust of bread around her already smeared clean bowl.
"But why a 1 hour exposure? Surely that wasn't necessary."
"Of course it wasn't," said Christian, "but people didn't know that then. Those sorts of exposure times were common."
"I suppose they figured if you got a good image in 15 minutes, you'd get an even better one in an hour," said Ruby.
"And it was before they knew the dangers. X-rays were only discovered in 1895, so Dr. Matthews was being pretty cutting-edge using them. People actually thought they were good for you in the beginning, that they could cure cancer and skin lesions and other disorders. The burns were obvious enough, but it was years before the full extent of the negative effects was realized."
"That's what Rose's marks were," said Cassandra. "Burn scars."
Christian nodded. "Along with frying her ovaries, the X-ray exposure would certainly have burned her skin."
A gust of wind set thin branches to tracing noisy patterns on the window panes, and candlelight flickered as a cool ribbon of air slipped beneath the skirting board. Ruby placed her bowl inside Cassandra's, swiped a napkin across her mouth.
So, if Rose was infertile, who was Nell's mother?
I know the answer to that, said Cassandra.
You do?
She nodded. It's all there in the scrapbooks. In fact, I reckon that's what Clara wants to tell me.
Who's Clara? Said Christian.
Ruby inhaled.
You think Nell was Mary's baby?
Who's Mary? Christian looked between them. Eliza's friend, said Cassandra, Clara's mum, a domestic at Blackhurst who was dismissed in early 1909 when Rose discovered she was pregnant.
Rose dismissed her.
Cassandra nodded. In the scrapbook, she writes that she can't bear to think that someone so undeserving should have a child when she has been continually denied. Ruby swallowed a slurp of wine. But why would Mary have given her child to Rose?
I doubt she just gave her the child.
You think Rose bought the baby?
It's possible, right? People have done worse to secure a child.
Do you think Eliza knew? Said Ruby.
Worse than that, said Cassandra, I think she helped. I think that's why she went away.
Guilt? Exactly. She helped Rose use her position of power to wrangle a child from someone who needed money. Eliza can't have been comfortable with that. She and Mary were close, Rose says so.
You're presuming that Mary wanted the child, said Ruby. Didn't want to give her up.
I'm presuming the decision to give up a baby is never clean. Mary may have needed money. A baby may have been inconvenient. She may even have thought her child was going to a better home. But I still reckon it must have been devastating.
Ruby lifted her eyebrows.
And Eliza helped her.
Then she went away. That's what makes me think the baby wasn't given up happily.
I think Eliza went away because she couldn't bear to stay and watch Rose with Mary's baby. I think that when it came to separating mother and child, it was traumatic, and it played on Eliza's conscience.
Ruby nodded slowly. That would explain why Rose refused to see much of Eliza after Ivory was born, why the two of them drifted apart. Rose must have known how Eliza felt and worried that she'd do something to upset her newfound happiness.
Like, take Ivory back, said Christian.
Which she did in the end.
Yes, said Ruby. Which she did in the end.
She raised her eyebrows at Cassandra.
So, when do you see Clara?
She invited me to visit tomorrow, 11 o'clock.
Bugger, I'm leaving around 9. Bloody work. I would have loved to come. I could have given you a lift.
I'll take you.
This was Christian. He'd been playing with the knobs on the heater, turning the flame up, and the smell of kerosene was strong.
Cassandra avoided Ruby's grin.
Really? Are you sure?
He smiled as he met her gaze, held it for a moment before looking away.
You know me, always happy to help.
Cassandra smiled in reply, turned her attention to the table surface as her cheeks warmed. Something about Christian made her feel 13 again, and it was such a youthful, nostalgic feeling, displacement to a time and place when life was yet to happen to her, that she longed to cling to it. To push aside the guilty sense that by enjoying Christian's company, she was somehow being disloyal to Nick and Leo.
So, why do you think Eliza waited until 1913?
Christian looked from Ruby to Cassandra.
To take Nell back, I mean.
Why not do it earlier?
Cassandra ran her hand lightly along the top of the table, watched the candlelight dapple across her skin. I think she did it because Rose and Nathaniel died in the train crash. My guess is that despite her mixed feelings, she was willing to stand back while Rose was made happy. But once Rose was dead... Exactly. Her eyes met his. Something in the seriousness of his expression brought a shiver to her spine. Once Rose was dead, she could no longer bear for Ivory to remain at Blackhurst. I think she took the little girl and intended to give her back to Mary. Then why didn't she? Why did she put her on the boat to Australia? Cassandra exhaled, and the nearby candle's flame wavered. I haven't quite worked that bit out. Neither had she worked out how much, if anything, William Martin had known when he met with Nell in 1975. Mary was his sister. Wouldn't he have known if she'd been pregnant? If she'd given birth to a baby she didn't then raise? And surely if he'd known she was pregnant, had known the part Eliza played in the unofficial adoption, he'd have said as much to Nell. After all, if Mary was Nell's mother, then William was her uncle. Cassandra couldn't imagine that he'd have remained silent if a long-lost niece turned up on his doorstep. Yet there was no mention in Nell's notebook of any such recognition from William. Cassandra had pored over the pages, looking for hints she might have missed. William had neither said nor done anything to suggest that Nell was family to him. It was possible, of course, that William hadn't realized Mary was pregnant. Cassandra had heard of such occurrences in magazines and on American talk shows, girls who concealed their pregnancies the full 9 months. And it made sense that Mary would have done so. In order for the exchange to work, Rose would have insisted on discretion. She couldn't have had the small village aware that her baby wasn't her own. But was it really likely that a girl could fall pregnant, get engaged to her boyfriend, lose her job, give the baby away, resume her life, and no one know anything about it? There was something Cassandra was missing. There must be. It's kind of like Eliza's fairy tale. Isn't it? Cassandra looked up at Christian. What is? The whole thing. Rose, Eliza, Mary, the baby. Doesn't it remind you of the golden egg? Cassandra shook her head. The name was not familiar. It's in magical tales for girls and boys. Not in my copy. We must have different editions. There was only one edition. That's why they're so rare. Cassandra lifted her shoulders. I've never seen it. Ruby flapped her hand. Enough! Who gives two hoots how many editions there were? Tell us about the story, Christian. What makes you think it's about Mary and the baby? It's an odd one, actually. The golden egg. I always felt that. Different to the other fairy tales. Sadder, and with a shakier moral frame. It's about a wicked queen who coerces a young maiden into giving up a magical golden egg to heal the ailing princess of the land. The maiden resists at first, because it's her life's work to guard the egg. Her birthright, I think, is how she describes it. But the queen wears her down, and in the end she consents, because she's convinced that if she doesn't, the princess will suffer eternal sorrow, and the kingdom will be cursed to an endless winter. There is a character who plays the go-between in the transaction, the handmaiden. She works for the princess and the queen, but when it comes down to it, she tries to convince the maiden not to part with the egg. It's as if she realizes that the egg is a part of the maiden, that without it, the maiden will have no purpose, no reason to live. Which is exactly what happens. She hands over the egg, and it ruins her life. You think the handmaiden was Eliza? said Cassandra. It fits, doesn't it?
Ruby leaned her chin on her fist. Let me get this straight. You're saying the egg was the child, Nell?
Yes.
And Eliza wrote the story as a way to assuage her guilt.
Christian shook his head. Not guilt. The story doesn't feel guilty. It's more like sadness. For herself and for Mary. And for Rose, in a way. The characters in the story are all doing what they think is right. It's just that it can't have a happy ending for all of them.
Cassandra bit her lip thoughtfully. You really think a children's fairy tale might be autobiographical?
Not autobiographical exactly, not in a literal sense, unless she had some pretty wacky experiences.
He raised his eyebrows at the thought.
I just reckon Eliza probably processed bits of her own life by turning them into fiction. Isn't that what writers do?
I don't know, do they?
I'll bring the golden egg with me tomorrow, said Christian. You can judge for yourself.
The warm ochre candlelight accented his cheekbones, made his skin glow. He smiled shyly.
Her fairy tales are the only voice Eliza has anymore. Who knows what else she's trying to tell us?
After Christian left to make his way back to the village, Ruby and Cassandra laid their sleeping bags out on the foam mattress he'd brought for them. They decided to stay downstairs so they could take advantage of the still warm range, and had pushed the table aside to make room. Wind from the sea blew gently through cracks beneath the doors, up between the gaps in the floorboards. The house had a smell of damp soil, more so than Cassandra had noticed in the daytime.
This is the part where we tell each other ghost stories,
whispered Ruby, rolling over heavily to face Cassandra. She grinned, face shadowy in the flickering light.
What fun. Have I told you how lucky you are to have a haunted cottage on the edge of a cliff?
Once or twice. She gave a cheeky smile.
What about how lucky you are to have a friend like Christian, who's handsome, clever, and kind?
Cassandra concentrated on the zip of her sleeping bag, drew it up with a precision and attention to detail far outweighing the task.
A friend who obviously thinks the sun shines out of you.
Oh, Ruby, Cassandra shook her head. He does not. He just likes helping in the garden.
Ruby raised her eyebrows, amused. Of course, he likes the garden. That's why he's given up the better part of a fortnight to work for nothing.
It's true.
Of course it is.
Cassandra bit back a smile and adopted a slightly indignant tone. Whether you believe it or not, the hidden garden is very important to Christian. He used to play in it as a kid.
And that intense passion for the garden must explain why he's taking you to Polperro tomorrow.
He's just being nice. He's a nice person. It's nothing to do with me, with how he feels about me. He certainly doesn't like me.
Ruby nodded sagely. You're right, of course. I mean, what's to like?
Cassandra glanced sideways, smiled despite herself.
So, she said, biting her bottom lip, you think he's handsome?
Ruby grinned.
Sweet dreams, Cassandra.
Good night, Ruby. Cassandra blew out the candle, but a full moon meant that the room wasn't completely dark. A silvery film spilled across every surface, smooth and dull, like wax gone cool. She lay in the half-light, running pieces of the puzzle through her mind. Eliza, Mary, Rose. Then every so often, out of place, Christian
meeting her gaze before looking away. Within a couple of minutes, Ruby was snoring softly. Cassandra smiled to herself. She might have guessed Ruby was an easy sleeper. She closed her own eyes, and each lid gained weight. As the sea swirled at the base of the cliff, and the trees overhead whispered in the midnight wind, Cassandra, too, drifted into sleep. She was in the garden, the hidden garden, sitting beneath the apple tree on the softest grass. The day was very warm, and a bee droned around the apple blossoms, hovering near before floating away on the breeze. She was thirsty, longed for a drink of water, but none was nearby. She reached out her hand, tried to push herself to standing, but couldn't. Her stomach was huge and swollen, the skin tight and itchy beneath her dress. She was pregnant. As soon as she realized, the sensation became familiar. She could feel her heart pumping heavily, the warmth of her skin. Then the baby started to kick. Cass? Kicked so hard, enough force that her stomach lurched on one side. She laid her hand on her bump, tried to catch the little foot. Cass? Her eyes opened. Moonlight on the walls. The ticking of the range. Ruby was propped up on one arm, tapping her shoulder. Are you all right? You are groaning. I'm fine. Cassandra sat up suddenly, felt her stomach. Oh, my God, I had the strangest dream. I was pregnant, very pregnant. My stomach was huge and tight, and everything was so vivid. She rubbed her eyes. I was in the walled garden, and the baby started to kick. It's all that talk earlier of Mary's baby and Rose and golden eggs all getting mixed up together. Not to mention the wine, Cassandra yawned, but it was so real. It felt exactly like the real thing. I was so uncomfortable and hot, and when the baby kicked, it was so painful. You paint a lovely picture of pregnancy, said Ruby. You're making me glad I never tried it. Cassandra smiled. It's not much fun in the final months, but it's worth it in the end. That moment when you finally hold a tiny new life in your arms. Nick had cried in the delivery room, but Cassandra hadn't. She'd been too present, too much a part of the powerful moment to react in such a way. To cry would have necessitated a second level of feeling, an ability to step outside events and view them within a larger context. Cassandra's experience had been too immediate for that. She'd felt fired from within by a sort of dizzy jubilation, as if she could hear better, see better than she ever had before. Could hear her own pulse pumping, the lights humming above, her new baby's breaths. Actually, I was pregnant once, said Ruby, but only for about 5 minutes. Oh, Ruby, Cassandra was awash with sympathy. You lost the baby? In a manner of speaking. I was young, it was a mistake. He and I agreed it was stupid to go through with it. I figured there was plenty of time later for all that. She lifted her shoulders, then smoothed her sleeping bag across her legs. Only problem was, by the time I was ready, I no longer had the necessary ingredients at my disposal. Cassandra leaned her head to the side. Sperm, my dear. I don't know whether I spent my entire 30s with PMT, but for whatever reason the greater population of menfolk and I failed to see eye to eye. By the time I met a bloke I could live with, the baby ship had sailed. We tried for a while, but... She shrugged. Well, you can't fight nature. I'm sorry, Ruby. Don't be. I'm doing all right. I have a job I love. Good friends. She winked. And come on, you've seen my flat? I'm onto a winner there. No room to swing a cat.
But hey, I haven't got a cat to swing.
Cassandra smiled.
You make a life out of what you have, not what you're missing.
Ruby lay down again and snuggled into her sleeping bag. She pulled it up around her shoulders.
Nighty-night.
Cassandra continued to sit for a while, watching shadows dance along the walls as she thought about what Ruby had said. About the life that she, Cassandra, had built out of the things, the people, she was missing. Was that what Nell had done too? Forsaken the life and the family she'd been given to focus instead on the one she'd been without? Cassandra lay down and closed her eyes. Let the nighttime sounds drown out her disquieting thoughts. The sea breathing, waves crashing against the great black rock, treetops shushing in the wind. The cottage was a lonely place, isolated by day, but even more so once darkness fell. The road didn't extend all the way up the cliff. The entrance to the hidden garden had been closed off, and beyond it lay a maze whose route was difficult to follow. It was the sort of place one might live in and never see another soul. A sudden thought, and Cassandra gasped, sat upright. "Ruby?" she said. Then louder, "Ruby!"
"Asleep," came the slurred response.
"But I just figured it out."
"Still asleep."
"I know why they built the wall, why Eliza went away. That's why I had the dream. My unconscious figured it out and was trying to let me know."
A sigh. Ruby rolled over and propped herself on a bent arm. "You win. I'm awake. Just."
"This is where Mary stayed when she was pregnant with Ivory, with Nell. Here in the cottage. That's why William didn't know she was pregnant."
Cassandra leaned closer to Ruby.
"That's why Eliza went away. Mary was here instead. They kept her hidden in the cottage, built the wall so that no one would accidentally catch sight of her."
Ruby rubbed her eyes and sat up. "They turned this cottage into a cage until the baby was born and Rose was made a mother."
Chapter 44, Tregenna, 1975. The afternoon before she was due to leave Tregenna, Nell went a last time to Cliff Cottage. She took the white suitcase with her, filled with the documents and research she'd collected during her visit. She wanted to look over her notes, and the cottage seemed as good a place as any in which to do so. At least that's what she'd told herself when she'd decided to make her way up the steep cliff road. It wasn't true, of course, not completely. For although she had wanted to look over the notes, that wasn't why she'd come to the cottage. She'd come simply because she couldn't stay away. She unlocked the door and pushed it open. Winter was approaching, and the cottage was cool. Stale air sat thick and heavy in the hallway. Nell took the suitcase upstairs to the bedroom. It pleased her to look out over the silver sea, and on her last visit she'd spied a little bentwood chair in the corner of the room that would serve her purposes very well. The cane had unraveled from the back, but that was no impediment. Nell positioned the chair by the window, sat tentatively, and opened the white suitcase. She leafed through the papers inside. Robin's notes on the Mountrachet family, the contact details of the detective she'd hired to look into Eliza's whereabouts, searches and correspondence from the local solicitors about her purchase of Cliff Cottage. Nell found the letter relating to the property boundaries and flipped it over to study the surveyor's map. She could see quite clearly now the area young Christian had told her was a garden. She wondered who on earth had bricked up the gate and why. As she pondered, the paper slipped from Nell's hand and fluttered to the ground. She reached down to pick it up, and something caught her eye. Damp weather had buckled the skirting board, pulled it loose from the wall. A piece of paper was wedged behind. Nell caught the corner between her fingers and retrieved it. A small piece of card, spotted with foxing, on which a woman's face had been drawn, framed by an arch of brambles. Nell recognized her from the portrait she'd seen in the gallery in London. It was Eliza Makepeace. But there was something different about this sketch. Unlike the Nathaniel Walker portrait in London that made her look untouchable, this one was somehow more intimate. Something in the eyes suggested that this artist had been better acquainted with Eliza than had Nathaniel. Bold lines, certain curves, and the expression. Something in her eyes both compelled Nell and confronted her. Nell smoothed over the top of the card. To think it had been lying there in wait for so long. She pulled the book of fairy tales from the suitcase. She hadn't been precisely sure why she'd brought it with her to the cottage, only that there seemed a pleasant symmetry in bringing the stories home, back to the very place in which Eliza Makepeace had written them. Undoubtedly silly, embarrassingly sentimental, but there you are. Now, Nell was glad she had. She opened the cover and slipped the sketch inside. That would keep it safe. She leaned back against the chair and ran her fingers over the book's cover, the smooth leather and raised center panel with its illustration of a maiden and a fawn. It was a beautiful book, as beautiful as any that had passed through Nell's antiques shop. And it was so well preserved, decades spent in Hugh's care had done it no harm. Though it was earlier times she sought to recall, Nell found her mind returning over and again to Hugh. In particular, the nights he'd read her bedtime stories from the fairy tale book. Lil had been concerned, worried they might be too scary for a little girl, but Hugh had understood. In the evenings, after dinner, when Lil was clearing the day away, he would collapse back into his wicker chair, and Nell would curl up in his lap. The pleasant weight of his arms wrapped around her to grasp the edges of the book, the faint smell of tobacco on his shirt, the rough whiskers on his warm cheek catching her hair. Nell sighed steadily. Hugh had done well by her, he and Lil both. All the same, she blanked them out and willed her mind back further. For there was a time before Hugh, a time before the boat trip to Maryborough, the time of Blackhurst and the cottage and the authoress. There, a white cane garden chair, sun, butterflies. Nell closed her eyes and clutched the memory's tail, let it drag her into a warm summer's day, a garden where shade spilled cool across a sprawling lawn, air filled with the scent of sun-baked flowers. The little girl was pretending to be a butterfly. A woven wreath of flowers encircled her head, and she was holding her arms out to the sides, running in circles, fluttering and swooping while the sunlight warmed her wings. She felt so grand as the sun turned the white cotton of her dress to silver. "Ivory?" At first the little girl did not hear, for butterflies do not speak the languages of men. They sing in sweetest tone, with words so beautiful grown-up ears cannot hear them. Only children notice when they call. "Ivory, come quickly!" There was a sternness to Mama's voice now, so the little girl swooped and fluttered in the direction of the white garden chair. "Come, come!" said Mama, reaching out her arms, beckoning with the pale tips of her fingers. With a warm happiness spreading beneath her skin, the little girl climbed up. Mama wrapped her arms around the little girl's waist and pressed cool lips against the skin beneath her ear. "I'm a butterfly," the little girl said. "This chair is my cocoon." "Shh! Quiet now," Mama's face was still pressed close, and the little girl realized she was looking at something beyond. The little girl turned to see what it was that held Mama's attention so. A lady was coming towards them. The little girl squinted into the sun to make some sense of this mirage. For this lady was different from the others who came to visit Mama and Grandmama, the ones who stayed for tea and games of bridge. This lady looked somehow like a girl stretched to grown-up height. She wore a dress of white cotton, and her red hair was only loosely tied in place. The little girl looked about for the carriage that must have brought the lady up the drive, but there was none. It seemed that she had materialized from thin air, as if by magic. Then the little girl realized. She caught her breath, filled with wonder. The lady was not walking from the direction of the entrance. She had come from inside the maze. The little girl was forbidden to enter the maze. It was one of the first and sternest rules. Both Mama and Grandmama were always reminding her that the way was dark and filled with untold dangers. So serious was the decree that even Papa, who could usually be relied upon, dared not disobey. The lady was still hurrying directly towards them, half walking, half skipping. She had something with her, a brown paper parcel, under her arm. Mama's own arms tightened around the little girl's middle so that pleasure slipped towards discomfort. The lady stopped before them. "Hello, Rose." The little girl knew this was Mama's name, and yet Mama said nothing in return. "I know I'm not supposed to come." A silvery voice, like a spider's thread, which the little girl would have liked to hold between her fingers. "Then why have you?" The lady held out her parcel, but Mama did not take it. Her grip tightened again. "I want nothing from you." "I don't bring it for you." The lady put the parcel on the seat. "It is for your little girl." The parcel had contained the book of fairy tales. Nell remembered that now. There had been a discussion later between her mother and father. She had insisted on the book's banishment, and he had eventually agreed, taken it with him. Only he hadn't thrown it away. He had put it in his studio, next to the battered copy of Moby Dick. And he had read it to Nell when she sat with him, when her mother was ill and unaware. Thrilled by the memory, Nell stroked the front cover again. The book had been a gift from Eliza. She opened it carefully to the place where the ribbon bookmark had lain for 60 years. It was deep plum, only slightly frayed where the weave had begun to unravel, and it marked the beginning of a story called The Crone's Eyes. Nell began to read about the young princess who didn't know she was a princess, who journeyed across the sea to the land of lost things to bring back the crone's missing sight. It was distantly familiar, as a favored tale from childhood ought to be. Nell placed the bookmark in its new spot and closed the book, laid it back on the windowsill. She frowned and leaned closer. There was still a gap in the spine where the ribbon had been. Nell opened the book again. The pages fell automatically once more to the crone's eyes. She ran her finger down the inside of the spine. There were pages missing. Not many. Only 5 or 6, barely noticeable, but missing all the same. The excision was neat. No rough edges, tight up against the binding. Done with a penknife, perhaps? Nell checked the page numbers. They jumped from 54 to 61. The gap fell perfectly between two stories. The Golden Egg by Eliza Makepeace.
A long time ago, when seeking was finding, there lived a young maiden in a tiny cottage on the edge of a large and prosperous kingdom. The maiden had few means, and her cottage was hidden so deeply within the dark woods as to be obscured from common view. There had been those long ago who knew of the little cottage with its stone fireplace, but such folk had long since passed, and Mother Time had drawn a veil of forget around the cottage. Aside from the birds who came to sing on her windowsill, and the woodland animals who came in search of her warm hearth, the maiden was alone. Yet was she never lonely or unhappy, for the maiden of the cottage was too busy to pine for company she'd never had. Deep within the heart of the cottage, behind a special door with a shiny lock, there was a very precious object. A golden egg, whose glow was said to be so brilliant, so beautiful, that those whose eyes are lit upon it were rendered instantly blind. The golden egg was so old that no one could properly remember its age, and for countless generations the maiden's family had been charged with its protection. The maiden did not question this responsibility, for she knew it to be her destiny. The egg must be kept safe and well and hidden. Most importantly, the egg's existence must be kept secret. Many years before, when the kingdom was new, great wars had erupted over the golden egg, for legend told that it had magical powers and could grant its possessor his heart's desire. So it was the maiden kept her vigil. By day she sat at her little spinning wheel in the cottage window, singing happily with the birds who gathered to watch her work. By night she offered shelter to her animal friends and slept in the warmth of the cottage, heated from within by the glow of the golden egg. And she remembered always that there was naught more important than protecting one's birthright. Meanwhile, far away across the land in the kingdom's grand castle, there lived a young princess who was good and fair, but very unhappy. Her health was poor, and no matter that her mother, the queen, had scoured the land for magic or medicine, nothing could be found to make the princess well. There were those who whispered that when she was but a babe, a wicked apothecary had cursed her to eternal ill health. But no one dared utter such sentiment aloud. For the queen was a cruel ruler, whose wrath her subjects wisely feared. The queen's daughter, however, was the apple of her mother's eye. Each morning the queen paid a visit to her bedside, but alas, each morning the princess was the same, pale, weak, and weary. "It is all I wish, mother," she would whisper. "The strength to walk through the castle gardens, to dance at the castle balls, to swim in the castle waters. To be well is my heart's desire." The queen had a magic looking-glass from which she gleaned the comings and goings of the kingdom. And day after day she asked, "Mirror of mine, favored friend, show me the healer who will bring this horror's end." But each day the mirror gave the same answer. "There is no one, my queen, in all the land who can make her well by his healing hand." Now one day it happened that the queen was so upset by her daughter's condition that she forgot to ask the looking-glass her usual question. Instead, she began to sob.